Professor Burke, friends, it is an enormous privilege to be with you this evening to take part in this series under the umbrella of the Templeton Foundation that has done so much to establish creative dialogue between religion and science. And here in Cambridge, where so many of the great scientific discoveries were made that changed our world, from Isaac Newton to Sir Charles Babbage, in whose hall we are sitting, and Alan Turing. Between them, the two laid so many of the intellectual foundations of computing and artificial intelligence, and of course the home of Crick and Watson, whose discovery of DNA in 1953 allowed us to decode what we have always called in Judaism Sefer HaChaim, the Book of Life. We always suspected that life was a book, and we thank Crick and Watson for proving it. I do want, on behalf of all of you, I'm sure you will join me in wishing Sir Brian Heap, who issued the invitation, a speedy and complete recovery, and we hope he'll be back in full health with us soon. Friends, tonight I was asked to speak about science and religion. I will talk a little at the beginning and the end about that relationship in general, and in the middle to look at just one question of some specificity, cloning and stem cell research. And nonetheless, because I'm a rabbi, I have to begin with a story. And therefore, let me begin with my favorite story about science and religion. It happened around 1973, when the enormous oil crisis was happening and everyone was worried about how on earth they drive their car. And the story is told about the Orthodox Jewish scientist who, summoning the full power of the supernatural, invented a car that ran on faith. To get it to start, you sat in it, meditated on the Almighty and said, "Thank God." And to get it to stop, you said, "Amen." Well, the car was absolutely brilliant success. It absolutely worked. Until one day, the scientist took it for a test drive up a mountain. It was fine going up the mountain, but coming down, the car started going faster and faster and faster down these hairpin bends. And he uttered an "Amen," and nothing happened. By now the car is getting faster and faster and veering across the road. And he says, "Amen," and nothing happens. And finally the car slips off the road, just about to crash down a sheer cliff. And the scientist gathers all his powers of belief and shouts an almighty "Amen." And the car comes to a halt, its two front wheels into space. And the scientist leans back into his seat and says, "Thank God." Friends, sometimes it seems as if our world in the 21st century is that car on that mountain. Or as a fabled Russian politician in the communist days once said, "Friends, yesterday we stood on the edge of the abyss, but today we have taken a giant step forward." Well, we are in the midst, as a result, of a profound paradigm shift. There was a time, and we can call it definitive of modernity, when science, it was believed, would liberate society from religion and, as a result, inaugurate an era of unlimited progress. Science would free humanity from the tyranny of knowledge claims based on mere belief, revelation, or superstition. Technology would open up the bounties of nature. Under Adam Smith's vision, the free market and its division of labor would yield potentially unlimited economic growth. And much of that configuration of beliefs was true. But by now, however, we're aware of some of the downsides, some of the darker sides of technology. Number one, the rapid depletion of the Earth's natural resources, the massive ongoing loss of biodiversity and the damage we're doing to our ecosystem and the world's biosphere. Secondly, the dehumanization of life threatened by genetic engineering, reproductive cloning, which I will speak about a little, psychotropic drugs, in other words, the control of mood and behavior and without reference to the human will. And thirdly, of course, the sheer threat to human life posed by weapons of mass destruction, which are available more and more to groups, small groups, extraterritorial groups with quite dangerous beliefs. And even without sophisticated technology, we still have the highly primitive technology which created the disaster of 9/11 and the following anthrax attacks. And there is always, as our understanding of chemistry and biology grows, an ongoing worry that chemical and biological weapons will be used at some stage as part of a campaign of terror. And for the first time in a long time, or at least far more than in the past, these warnings are coming from scientists themselves. I think, for instance, of E.O. Wilson's book, The Future of Life, Susan Greenfield's book, Tomorrow's People, and one of the great figures of Cambridge, the astronomer Royal Sir Martin Rees's sobering book, Our Final Century. And perhaps it is more sobering still to recall these words, very profound words, uttered actually in 1924. And hear how they resonate today. Science has not given men more self-control, more kindliness, or more power of discounting their passions in deciding on a course of action. It has given communities more power to indulge their collective passions. But by making society more organic, it has diminished the part played by private passions. Men's collective passions are mainly evil. Far the strongest of them are hatred and rivalry directed towards other groups. Therefore, at present, all that gives men power to indulge their collective passions is bad. That is why science threatens to cause the destruction of our civilization. Words said in 1924, not by a religious figure, but by Bertrand Russell. Now, therefore, tonight, since it's impossible to even scratch the surface of even one topic, I just want to look at general how science and religion might engage in creative dialogue as we attempt to think through these issues. What are the narratives? What are the principles and standards, values, if you like, that we might bring to bear on them? And I will take, as I say, just one example, reproductive cloning and stem cell research, as a kind of for instance about how we might think about these things and any other issues you can ask me about afterwards, or read my book, Dignity of Difference, where I deal with a lot of the other ones, but not this, and that because I didn't deal with this one in the book, I'm speaking about it tonight. And let me begin with an obvious question. Why should ancient traditions, Judaism, 4,000 years old, Christianity, 2,000 years old, and so on, be of any possible interest to contemporary dilemmas about the application of science? And let me now spell out why it is. You see, for several centuries now, beginning with the 17th century and with increasing speed in the last 50 years, we've been tantalized by the prospect that there might be some equivalent in the moral sphere to what science is in the sphere of nature, namely a universal, neutral, decision-making procedure based entirely on reason and observation, which would eliminate the need for a religious or spiritual or transcendental basis for ethics. Now, this is clearly a deep subject, but I want to explain very briefly why this prospect of a set of values that was entirely neutral has not been realized and will not be realized. And here it is. Let us take the first and most famous attempt, which is associated with the name of Jeremy Bentham and is usually called utilitarianism or consequentialism. Act so as to maximize the consequences or produce, in his famous phrase, the greatest happiness for the greatest number. Now, that was an attempt to put ethics on the kind of same kind of scientific basis as any other neutral and objective discipline. The trouble with it, and the reason that it has so systemically failed, is because of the phenomenon known to sociologists as the law of unintended consequences. For instance, if you take one simple technological invention, Gutenberg inventing the printing press around 1450, who could have foreseen in 1450 that what that one invention would in time lead to the Reformation, redrawing of the political map of Europe, the birth of science, the secular nation state, the individual, the free economy, the industrial revolution, all from one simple revolution. There is very little doubt that technologies whose birth we have witnessed in our own lifetime are equally fateful, if not more so. But it is utterly meaningless to talk about maximizing consequences when we haven't got a clue what those consequences will be. Instead, it seems to me that we have to draw back from that and concentrate on doing what is right, not what is effective, by using the accumulated wisdom of mankind. And the reason is, to put it simply, when you are entering uncharted territory, don't ask for a map. There isn't one. What you need is something else. You take a compass. And in our case, that compass called the educated conscience, educated in exposure to the moral and ethical heritage of the West. Second option, supposing consequentialism or utilitarianism fails. There is a second option, much in favor nowadays, which is that when it comes to making choices, we should turn instead to the idea of personal choice. The language which dominates current speech, the language of rights. And the language of rights, as you know, is used very much in the case of the argument for reproductive cloning. It is called reproductive autonomy. Every person must have a right to make his or her own decisions. Now, yet again, autonomy is an important idea. It is a valuable idea, but it is wholly inadequate to medical ethics. Certainly, each of us have rights, but equally certainly, each of us has responsibilities. And there are few responsibilities more profound than those we bear towards those we bear, to the lives we bring into being. It might be very nice, he said as a new grandfather. I'm sorry, I'm thoroughly sentimental over her. It might be very nice to design our children to be clones of David Beckham or Britney Spears. But, I mean, at the end of the day, there's somebody else there, and that's called the child themselves. Parenthood is not only a matter of rights, it's also a matter of responsibilities, one of which is the responsibility to give our children the space to be themselves. And not what we wish them to be. Or as Harvard philosopher Hilary Putnam puts it, I think rather nicely, every child has a right to be a complete surprise to its parents. In short, the concept of autonomy is inadequate to deal with the issues of genetic intervention insofar as they affect the birth and fate of a human being, precisely because conflicting autonomies are at stake, the autonomy of the parent and the autonomy of the child. And of course, that realization that you're not going to get anywhere on the basis of autonomy, choice, or rights leads to the third option, which is probably the favored one today, which is we should leave these things to the market and to the march of time. After all, certain things are going to happen anyway. We may as well let them happen. If we ban reproductive cloning here, someone will go to Dr. Santori in Italy and have it done there, and if not there, they'll find somewhere else on the internet. And therefore, since it's going to happen anyway, let it happen. Whatever do we decide, whatever we legislate, in an era of global capitalism, people are going to find ways of getting what they want so long as they are willing to pay for it. And that seems to be the case in so many of these genetic issues. Let me say clearly and unequivocally that that is not a moral option. It is more precisely an abdication of morality. And it is simply wrong. If Homo sapiens is intelligent enough to create genetic technology, then Homo sapiens is intelligent enough to control genetic technology. The greatness of a civilization is measured not only by what it can do, but also by what it chooses for ethical reasons not to do. A civilization has to have the ethical courage from time to time to say no. For 6 days, God created the universe, and on the seventh, he rested in order to teach that there are limits to creation, even when you're God. The survival of our civilization depends on knowing those limits. And therefore, I am driven back to my favorite aphorism of all time: when all else fails, read the instructions. And therefore, it's important to remind ourselves where that journey that we call Western civilization began. Namely, with a book called Genesis, whose name comes from the same root as genetics. And with it, the single most important phrase in the history of Western civilization, that wonderful phrase in Genesis 1, Na'aseh Adam B'Tzalmenu Kidmutenu, let us, says God, make man in our image after our likeness. Let me now apply that concept and its related ones to two issues currently at stake, which are usually lumped together and actually I want to show are quite different, to genetics and to stem cell research. So let us begin by asking the first question. When we speak about genetic experimentation, manipulation, intervention into the human embryo, is this ethically warranted at all? And very often people with a strong religious background argue, no, it is a form of hubris. It is what we call playing God. The overwhelming answer of the Jewish tradition is that that concept does not exist. To the contrary, it is precisely the import of the phrase that we are in the image and likeness of God, that we are both created and creative. We are the only beings to use language, reflexivity, to have self-consciousness. In other words, the only beings thus far known to us in the universe capable of imagining a world different from the one that is. And therefore, we become the only beings capable of not just adapting to our environment, but of adapting our environment to us. And what that meant is summed up in the first commandment, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, which means that with certain very real and substantive moral provisos, but with those provisos, God wants us to increase scientific knowledge. God wants us to develop technology. That is part of the mandate of that verse. Therefore, in Judaism, there is no concept of something being forbidden because it's playing God. On the contrary, the rabbinic tradition speaks of God, 2,000 years ago, speaks of God calling on us to be, in their phrase, partners, his partners in the work of creation. Or in the lovely phrase of our liturgy, to perfect the world under the sovereignty of God. We have a specific mandate in the book of Exodus, which says that if you hit somebody and cause him damage, you have to pay his medical bills. I don't suppose they were quite as high in biblical days as they are now, but from this phrase, the rabbis learned that there is a mandate for the physician to heal, and therefore, curing disease and medicine as a way of serving God is fundamental to medieval Jewry. One of the greatest rabbi in the Middle Ages, Moses Maimonides, was in fact the royal physician to the Sultan at Cairo, author of 8 medical textbooks, and a pioneer of preventive medicine. He actually writes in his law code a series of prescriptions for diet, exercise, and sleep, and then says, in a law code, I personally guarantee that anyone who follows this regime will live a long life and never need a doctor and only die in old age. I don't know if anyone sued Maimonides on that point, but by the time you're dead, it's probably not a good time to sue anyone. Anyway, and one can go further, and anyway, all I would say is that that particular problem is not one in Judaism. However, the question now is, what according to the Bible are the limits, the restraints, the constraints? And the simplest answer is best expressed, and this applies to environmental ethics, in Genesis chapter 2, not chapter 1. See, in Genesis 1, man is given the mandate to conquer or subdue nature, but in Genesis 2, man is planted on this earth in the Hebrew words, le'ovda'u le'shamra, to serve it, to work it, and to preserve or guard it. And that second word, le'shamra, is actually a technical term, a legal term in biblical law. When Cain says, am I my brother's keeper? He is using the same verb. Adam was placed in the garden to keep it, to preserve it, to conserve it. To be the guardian of something means that we don't own it. We don't own the universe, we don't own, and we may not patent natural phenomena. We don't own human life, we are its guardians. And therefore we are charged with protecting it, conserving it, and if possible, improving it. If possible, improving it, which reminds me of that wonderful, that Jews have been fairly famous for their modesty, and therefore I love the Yiddish translation of Shakespeare, which carries on it the famous words, verteidigt und verbessert, translated and improved. However, that, in my view, is the best criterion for determining where and when in genetic engineering intervention into the human embryo, into human cells, is justified and permitted, and where it is forbidden. The best way is to say that we do not own nature, the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, and therefore, will an act we perform honor the trust vested in us to hand on the environment, to hand on our genetic heritage, to hand on biodiversity, undamaged, undiminished, and if possible, enhanced to future generations. We have a covenantal responsibility to God as the owner of nature and to future generations as those whose future we hold in trust. Now, clearly that will raise very large questions about germline as opposed to somatic cell interventions, because germline interventions have effects that are passed on through the generations. And that will raise questions about any procedure that may have potentially hazardous or lasting consequences. And that in itself will be serious enough to say no to any widespread use of reproductive cloning. Apart from any other ethical objection, it will have the effect of reducing genetic diversity, which is presumably precisely why all larger and more complex life forms have developed sexual reproduction, which is a continually renewed source of genetic creativity, of unexpected combinations. So there is no problem in Judaism of playing God as far as genetic engineering is concerned. But yes, there is a clear injunction against damaging our genetic heritage insofar as that may affect future generations. Now we come to a serious question about genetic research in general, and that is the kind of work that is going on now on embryonic or stem cells and therapeutic cloning. Now, in a very large measure, these turn on the question, is the fetus or the pre-implanted embryo created perhaps in a test tube, is that a person? Is their destruction a form of murder? In short, what is the moment of inception of life? And here I want to just give you a little insight into how a religious tradition can come up with perhaps an unexpected answer and make us think twice. As you know, Today, there is an enormous range of views on that question. It is deeply contested. And it turns on large issues of theology, metaphysics, biblical interpretation, and ranges from the Catholic tradition, which predicates sanctity of life on the fetus from the moment of conception, and also attaches sanctity of life on the pre-implanted embryo, all the way to the other extreme of views like Francis Crick and the philosopher Peter Singer, who in varying degrees argue for the moral permissibility of actually killing very young children in case of severe handicap or genetic disease, a measure of infanticide, which is argued for in contemporary literature. Now, these are differences so wide and so intense that one's tempted to say they are irresolvable and interminable. There's a huge literature on the subject, part theological, part philosophical, part historical, and part hysterical. But one way or another, here I want to show how Judaism and Christianity part company on this big question. One of the most interesting chapters in the history of thought is how Christianity and Jewish teachings diverge on this question of life before birth. And because so much has been written about it, I will only try and say tonight something that I haven't seen written that might help us think more clearly about these issues. I want to make two distinctions. The first is between ontology and deontology, what is and what ought to be, or physis and nomos, cosmos, ethos, is, ought, scientific law, descriptive law, and moral law, prescriptive law. Imagine you are flying up to Glasgow and the day is clear and you notice the scenery change from the wonderful flat landscape of the Fens and Cambridge to the nice rolling hills of the north where the whiskey is so wonderful. And you can sort of see a clear change from an English characteristic English landscape to a characteristic Scottish landscape. But if you were to ask precisely on what point of the map the topography ceases to be English and becomes Scottish, could you give an answer? No. It is absurd. Why? Because there are no boundaries in nature. Nature is a series of gradual and changes. On the other hand, if you were to ask, is there a clear boundary between is there a clear point at which the fiscal, legal, educational, and health authorities are English or Scottish? Is there a clear point? The answer is clearly yes. You can draw an exact line on the map, and if you couldn't, we'd all be in trouble. There are clear boundaries in law. If you try and tell a policeman who books you on the charge that you went through a red light, if you actually said there is no specific point at which light becomes red, it merely merges imperceptibly to orange. Listen, guys, if you get away with it, let me know, because so you understand that in nature there are no clear boundaries, in law there are. And therefore the real question, not only on these technical questions of stem cell research, cloning and pre-implanted embryos, but even on abortion itself, is not abortion right or wrong, stem cell research right or wrong. The real question is ethics like nature or is ethics like law? That is the question. If ethics are like nature, then there are no clear boundaries, only a gradual, imperceptible development from the first fertilized cells to the living child. In which case, you could say human life begins at the very start of that process, or only when the process is complete, when the child is already recognizably human in faculties some months after birth. And that is the debate as it exists today, and it cannot be resolved because there are no boundaries in nature. So you get these extreme views that any creation or manipulation of embryos is wrong, all the way to infanticide may be permissible in the first year of life. However, and those really cannot be resolved. However, there is a second possibility, namely that ethics is not like nature, it is like law. In which case, there must be a clear boundary. The Jewish view is precisely that, that it's a category mistake to think of ethics on the analogy of nature. Instead, it belongs to the network of relationships, obligations, duties, and prohibitions that we call cultural rather than natural, prescriptive rather than descriptive. Ethics belongs to the same sphere of discourse as law. If so, then there is a clear boundary, and it exists in every culture known to mankind, and it is called birth. Until birth, the fetus is not a person. From birth, the fetus is. That is the clear boundary at which we can strike a line that makes reasonable sense by way of law. And now we understand why there has been such continuing debate on this subject, certainly on abortion, between Judaism and Christianity for the last 2,000 years. Because Western civilization is formed on the basis of two quite different cultures, ancient Greece and ancient Israel. Ancient Greece saw ethics in terms of nature, ancient Israel saw ethics in terms of law, and Christianity was formed in the meeting of those two cultures. That is the first distinction. The second distinction, I think, is no less important. The distinction between a person and human life. They sound the same, but they're not at all. In Jewish law, the fetus is not a person. The pre-implanted embryo is not a person. But it is human life. Personhood, with all its rights and responsibilities, begins at birth. But prior to birth, we have duties to embryos, not because they are persons, but because they are human life. And the difference is that whereas our duties to a person may not be overridden by other moral concerns, our duties to human life may be overridden by other duties, not least the duties we owe persons. For instance, saving life or curing disease. And therefore, the conclusion to which we have come as a community, my rabbinical court has come, in the light of questions about stem cell research and so on, has been the following. That embryos, on the one hand, may not be created in the laboratory simply for research purposes or to be destroyed. However, embryos created permissibly, namely surplus embryos produced in the course of in vitro fertilization, may be used for research, and that includes the embryonic stem cells or therapeutic cloning, the kind of cloning used to treat genetic disease. That is, in fact, the conclusion reached by the present government of the United States, and I'm not quite sure whether we've reached the same in Britain, but we are very likely to. And I have tried to show how it follows from a particular way about thinking through the complex issues involved. However, reproductive cloning is another matter altogether. We know, for instance, that before Dolly the sheep was successfully cloned, 277 cloned embryos were produced. Only 29 of them developed to the point where they could be implanted. Only one survived to term. We know that in all animal experiments to date, less than 3% of cloning attempts succeed, and there are fetal deaths, stillborn infants, and a high incidence of subsequent, initially undetected abnormalities, from one of which Dolly the sheep died itself. We believe, doctors believe, that there is a basic genetic instability that emerges from the process of cloning that puts such embryos at risk of subsequent deformation and premature death. Cloning apparently disturbs the normal process of genomic imprinting by which the genes on the chromosomes from one of the parents are switched on or off. It follows that it is quite likely that mammalian cloning is an intrinsically flawed process, too unsafe ever to be used for human reproduction. However, cloning is not just bad because it is unlikely ever to be safe. It is bad on principle. The truth is that, not by accident, are we formed as the result of sexual rather than asexual reproduction? And it is that unpredictable combination of genes of two parents, grandparents, that generates the variety that our species needs in order to survive. Much more importantly, cloning is a threat to the integrity of children so born. People often say that cloning is no different from genetically identical twins. However, I think that is a quite spurious argument. It is one thing for this to occur, another thing quite deliberately to bring it about. Identical twins don't come into being so that one may serve as a substitute or a replacement or the source of compatible tissue for the other. Cloning, therefore, offends against the Kantian principle itself, based on a biblical principle that persons be treated as ends rather than means, and it will result in the long run in the commodification of human life. However, what is fundamental is that our very sense of personhood and everything that goes with it is based on the idea that the human person is unique and irreplaceable. And that is threatened if cloning heralds the possibility that those we have lost can be replaced through cloning or similar asexual reproductive techniques. And that is why it threatens at its very root the concept of our humanity. I don't know if any of you saw Steven Spielberg's film AI. You see this? I don't recommend it, actually. I can think of much better. Let's all go back to Jurassic Park. That was much more fun. But, you know, it actually poses the question, could parents love a child they have selected from a production line? Can you love that which is reproducible? To which the film delivers the answer, which I think is the correct one, which is no, you can't. Our sense of love is inextricably linked to our sense of the uniqueness and the irreplaceability of a person, and therefore the possibility of loss and vulnerability. And the attempt to bypass these things will actually not advance technology so much as to destroy the very basis of our humanity. The rabbi said a very lovely thing, which I think has application to many other issues as well. Listen to this. They said, when a human being makes many coins in the same mint, they all come out the same. God makes all of us in the same mint, his image, and we all come out different. And I believe that difference, that unpredictability, that uniqueness and irreplaceability is at the very heart of our humanity and what will make reproductive cloning such a tragedy to the future of our species. So I've tried to give you one little example of how we could think through an issue in medical ethics using ancient ethical reflections, and perhaps coming to a surprising distinction, because those who are in favor of stem cell research tend to favor cloning, those who are against the one are against the other, whereas we are very much in favor of stem cell research and very much opposed to reproductive cloning. I just give you that as an example of where religious traditions do help us think through contemporary dilemmas. Anyway, let me end by being general again. Professor Stephen Hawking wrote a lovely book called A Brief History of Time. I don't know, did you ever get to the end? Did you understand that one? I'm going to give you an even briefer history of time. Here it is, three sentences. In the beginning, people believed in many gods. Then came monotheism and reduced them to one. Then came science and reduced them to none. That is a brief history of time. In the beginning, there was myth, then there was monotheism, and then came the moment when Laplace said, in those famous words, je n'ai besoin de cette hypothèse, I don't need God in order to explain the world. Now, that is the conventional view, that Judaism, Christianity, monotheism were a halfway stage in the long journey to science. And that is how the story is so often presented. I want to tell the story a different way, and perhaps a more interesting way. Ever since Homo sapiens stopped beating the tribal drums long enough to express a thought, we have all reflected on our place in the universe. We know that compared to all there is, we are infinitesimally small. At best, we're a ripple in the ocean, a grain of sand on the shore. The universe preceded us by billions of years. It will survive for billions of years after we're long gone. How then is our life, that fleeting shadow, related to the totality of things? And to this, there have always been two answers, and they are fundamentally opposed. There have been cultures, ancient ones and modern ones alike, that have seen reality in terms of vast impersonal forces. To the ancients, those forces were the sun, the sea, the storm, the flood. Today, those same forces are global economy, international politics, the environment, the internet, the spread of terror. What they have in common is that they are indifferent to us, just as a tidal wave is indifferent to those it sweeps away. Global warming, like terrorism, does not choose its victims. Economic recession doesn't pause to ask who is thrown out of work. Genetic mutation happens without anyone deciding to whom. On that view, the forces that govern the world are essentially blind. They are not addressed to us. We can stand in their path or we can step out of the way, but they are unmoved by our existence. They do not relate to us as persons. In such a world, human hope is a prelude to tragedy. The best we can do is combine hedonism and stoicism, seize what pleasures come our way, and take Prozac to anesthetize the pain. That is a coherent view. Its greatest expression is in Greek tragedy, and it is where our culture is heading today. At some stage in the history of ancient Israel, a different vision was born. One that saw in the cosmos the face of the personal. Without denying any of the world's appearances, it saw beyond them to a deeper reality, to a God who brought the universe into being, not as a scientist in a laboratory, but as a parent in and through love. In this vision, we are not insignificant, we are not alone. We are here because someone willed us into being, who wanted us to be, who knows our thoughts, who values us in our uniqueness, whose breath we breathe, and in whose arms we rest, someone in and through whom we are connected to all that is. Now, this was not a minor discovery, nor is it narrowly a religious one. It's as much about mankind as about God. To put it simply, by discovering God, our ancestors discovered humanity. For the first time, that momentous concept began to take shape, the idea of the human person. Every human person, regardless of race, status, religion, code, or creed, as a being of unique dignity. It began in those words, "Let us make man in our own image, after our own likeness." And from that grew the great ethical and political concepts that have shaped Western civilization for the past 1,000 years. Among them, human rights, the free society, the sanctity of life, and the dignity of difference. Finding God singular and alone, our ancestors discovered the human person, singular and alone. Finding God reaching out to us, they discovered the importance of human beings reaching out to one another. Haltingly, and then with growing confidence, they began to realize that God is not about power, but about relationship. He is found, therefore, not just in heaven, but in society, in the structures we make to honor his presence by honoring his image in other human beings. Faith is not a primitive form of science. It is about the ultimate reality of the personal and how we translate that into our shared and social world. And that is why I believe we need not only science and technology and laboratories, but also our places of reflection and even places of worship where we sustain and give expression. They have given us economic growth, scientific advance, democratic governance. Three of the treasures of the modern world. It's just that we also need the texts and contexts that remind us of the sacred stories and ethical principles that articulate our humanity and that have been driven in recent decades to the very margins of the public square. The pages of history are littered with the debris of civilizations that were in their time technologically supreme, from ancient Mesopotamia and Egypt to the Third Reich and the Soviet Union. I find it awe-inspiring to realize that the social orders that survived were those that valued not power but the powerless, not economic and military but spiritual strength, not the mass but the individual, in whose features they discerned the image of God. That is what will always constitute the good society. And if today that has become a marginal, politically incorrect, or counter-cultural view, so be it. Religions were always at their best when they were counter-cultural, when they challenged the consensus instead of running after it. Today we need to hear that voice again, loudly, fearlessly, and unequivocally, for the sake of our children and our future, and God, in whose reflection alone we see ourselves as we are called on to become. And since I've been terribly serious, and you've been really nice, let me just end with my second favorite scientific story, but here it is, I'm sure you know it. But when I arrived in Cambridge, of course, the first thing I ran for was Heffer's bookshop. By the time I came out, it was pouring! And I thought, wrong week, actually. Stephen will know we read the story of Noah 2 weeks ago. They're quite the wrong week for the flood, but here it is. It concerns a very religious Jew, Gershom Rosenblum, who lived in a little village in Romania. Not long ago, there was a warning that deluge and downpour was going to cause a flood, and everyone had to vacate the village. But Gershom Rosenblum, who was very obstinate, said, "I'm not moving. I am Gershom Rosenblum, and I have faith in the Lord." Well, the rains came. The valley got flooded. Somebody came up with a rowing boat and said, "Rosenblum, get in the boat. The place is about to be flooded." Rosenblum said, "I'm sorry, I'm Gershom Rosenblum, and I have faith in the Lord." Well, the rain continued to fall. The waters continued to rise. They sent a second boat. Again, Rosenblum says, "I am Gershom Rosenblum, I have faith in the Lord." The rain keeps falling, the water keeps rising. This time Rosenblum is standing on the roof. They send a helicopter, drop a rope ladder, say, "Rosenblum, stop being a lunatic. Climb onto the helicopter, are you going to drown?" Rosenblum said, "I'm not moving, I am Rosenblum, I have faith in the Lord." Well, the rain kept falling, the waters kept rising. Rosenblum had no choice but to swim. He swam, he sank, he drowned. Finally, as he arrived in heaven, he demanded a personal audience with the Almighty and brooked no opposition. When finally he was admitted to the divine presence, he said, "God, please, I am Gershom Rosenblum, and I had faith in you. Why didn't you save me?" And God said, "Rosenblum, I sent you two boats and a helicopter. What more do you want?" Friends, science is not about the supernatural. It is about the natural. God sends us in science and technology his two boats and his helicopter. Let us use it to enhance human life, not to devalue it. Let us exercise the three R's, reverence, responsibility, and restraint. And let us always dignify we who are written through and in the Book of Life. Thank you.